Nembet ended with a strict injunction. Lord Harab is further ordered to hold all his forces on the border. He is not to indulge in raids or scouting forays to the north. My Lord Nembet, these orders blindfold me and bind my sword arm. You are denying me the means of conducting this campaign in a prudent and efficient manner. Tanos protested in vain. Nembet sneered with the satisfaction of having forced his authority upon this young rival, and in having gained a measure of retribution. On such petty human emotions pivots the destiny of nations. Pharaoh himself announced his intention of taking his rightful place at the head of his army. For 1,000 years the Pharaoh had been present on the field whenever the decisive battles of history had been fought out. Although I had to admire the king's courage, I wished he had not chosen this moment to demonstrate it. Pharaoh Mamoza was no warrior, and his presence would do little to enhance our chances of victory. There might be some bolstering of morale when the troops saw him in the van, but on balance he and his train would be a greater hindrance than assistance to Lord Tanos. The king would not travel northwards to the battlefront alone. His entire court would attend him, including his senior wife and his son. The queen must have her retinue and Prince Memnon his tutors, and so I would be going north to Asyut and to the battlefront. Nobody knew nor understood this enemy. I felt that my mistress and the prince were being placed in unnecessary danger. On the other hand, the safety of a slave was of no account, except to the slave himself. I slept little the night before we sailed northwards, on the flood of the river, for Asyut and the battlefront. The further north we sailed, the more numerous and troublesome were the rumours and reports coming down from the front to feed upon our contentment and confidence, like locusts upon the standing crops. Often during the voyage, Tanos came aboard our vessel, ostensibly to discuss these with me. However, on each visit he spent some time with the prince and his mother. I have never held with the custom of women following the army into battle. In times of peace or war, they are a marvellous distraction. Even a warrior of Tanos' calibre could be diverted from his main purpose. All his mind should have been on the task ahead, but when I told him so, he laughed and clapped my shoulder. They give me a reason to fight. Don't worry, old friend, I shall be a lion defending his cub. Soon we encountered the first elements of the retreating army, straggling groups of deserters who were looting the villages as they fled southwards along the banks of the river. With very little ceremony and no hesitation at all, Tanos beheaded several hundred of them, and had their heads spiked on spears and planted along the bank as an example and a warning. Then he gathered up the others and regrouped them under reliable officers. There were no further desertions, and the troops stood to the colours with a new spirit. Our flotilla came to the walled city of Asyut, overlooking the river. In defiance of his orders from Nembet, Tanos left a small strategic reserve of 5,000 men here under the command of Remren. Then we sailed on northwards to take up our positions on the border, there to await the approach of the mysterious Shepherd King. The fleet lay at anchor across the river in its battle formations, but the vessels were under skeleton crews. The fighting men were disembarked with the main body of infantry and deployed upon the east bank of the river. I prevailed upon Pharaoh to allow my mistress and the prince to remain on board the large and comfortable barge that had brought them here. It was cooler and healthier out on the water, and their escape would be swifter if our army met with any reverse of arms. The king went ashore with the army and set up his camp on the higher ground above the inundated fields. There was a deserted village here. Years ago, the peasants had fled from this disputed border with the false Pharaoh. There were always foraging troops and bloody little skirmishes hereabouts, and the farmers had given up any attempts to work these fertile but dangerous fields. The name of the derelict village was Abnab. The flood of the Nile had begun to subside some weeks prior to our arrival at Abnab, and although the irrigation canals were still running strongly and the fields were morasses of black mud, the main waters had retreated back between the permanent banks of the Nile. Within the restrictions placed upon him by Nembet, Tanos set about preparing to meet the threat. The regiments encamped in their order of battle. Astes commanded the fleet on the river. Tanos himself had the centre, with his left flank anchored on the Nile, while Kratos had the right wing. The desert stretched to the eastern horizon, dun and forbidding. No army could survive out in that burning, waterless waste. It was our right flank, secure and impregnable. All that we knew of the Hyksos was that he had come over land, and that he possessed no fleet of his own. Thanos expected to meet him on land, and to fight an infantry engagement. Thanos knew that he could prevent the Hyksos from crossing the river, and so he should be able to bring him to battle on the field of his own choice. Ideally, this would not have been at Ubnub, but Nembet had made that decision for him. The village of Ubnub stood on a low ridge with open, untended fields around it. At least it commanded a good view, and the enemy would be under our observation long before it could engage and drive in our pickets. Thanos had 30,000 of the finest troops in Egypt under his command. I had never seen such a large force. Indeed, I doubt that an army of this size had ever before been assembled in the valley of the Nile. Soon Nembet would arrive with another 30,000. Then it would be the greatest army in history. I went with Thanos to inspect them, and the troops' morale had soared since he had taken command in person. Perhaps the presence of Pharaoh in the camp had also helped to steady them. They cheered Thanos as he strode along their massed ranks, and I felt much encouraged and relieved at the multitudes of their host and the spirit in them. I could not imagine an enemy powerful enough to overwhelm us. There were 12,000 archers with polished leather helmets and padded leather breastplates that would stop an arrow, except if it were fired at a very short range. There were 8,000 heavy spearmen with long shields of hippo skin as tough and hard as bronze. The 10,000 swordsmen in leopard-skin caps were also armed with slingshots, the stones from which could split a skull at 50 paces. I felt more confident with each day that passed, as I watched Thanos exercising these huge masses of armed men. Yet it worried me that we still knew so little about the Hyksos and the forces that he commanded. I pointed out to Thanos that the War Council had forbidden him to send land forces forward to reconnoitre, but had said nothing of vessels being used for this purpose. "You should have been a law scribe," Thanos laughed. "You can make words dance to any tune you play." But he ordered Huey to take a single squadron of fast galleys northwards as far as Minya, or until he encountered the enemy. This was the same Huey whom he had captured at Galala, and who had been one of Basti's shrikes. Under Thanos' favour, that young rogue had advanced swiftly, and now commanded a squadron of galleys. Huey had strict orders to avoid action and to report back within 4 days. Dutifully, he returned on the 4th day. He had reached Minya without seeing another ship or encountering any resistance. The villages along the river were all deserted, and the town of Minya itself had been sacked and was in flames. Huey had, however, captured a handful of deserters from the false pharaoh's shattered army. These were the first persons we had questioned who were actual eyewitnesses of the Hyksos invasion. However, none of them had ever stood to engage and actually fight the Shepherd King. They had all fled at his first approach. Their reports were therefore so far-fetched and garbled as to be completely incredible. How could we believe in the existence of an army that sailed across the open desert on ships that were as swift as the wind? According to our informants, the dust clouds that hung over the strange fleet were so tall as to obscure their numbers and to strike terror into any army that watched their advance. "These are not men," the prisoners reported. "They are fiends from the underworld, and they ride on the devil winds out of the desert." Having questioned the prisoners carefully, and finding that even hot coals on their heads could not make them alter their stories, Thanos ordered their summary execution. He did not want these wild tales circulating and spreading despondency amongst our forces, who had only recently regained their courage. On the 10th day of waiting at Ubnub, we received word that Nembet was at last on his way with reinforcements, and that he expected to reach Asyut within the next 2 weeks. The effect on the men was marvellous to behold. They were transformed at a stroke from sparrows to eagles. Thanos issued an extra ration of beer and meat to celebrate the news, and the cooking fires were a field of stars upon the plain before Ubnub. The luscious odour of burning mutton fat filled the night, and the sound of laughter and singing only died away in the final watches. I had left my mistress on board the barge with her son, and had come ashore in response to a summons from Tunnus. He wanted me to attend the final war council with his regimental commanders. You are always a well of ideas and wisdom, you old rascal. Perhaps you can tell us how to sink a fleet of ships that come sailing over dry land. Our deliberations went on until after midnight, and for once I was able to contribute very little of value. It was too late to return to the ship that night, so Tunnus gave me a straw mattress in the corner of his tent. I awoke before dawn, as was my habit, but Tunnus was gone from his bed, and beyond the coarse linen wall of the tent the camp was already astir. I felt guilty of indolence, and hastened out to watch the dawn breaking over the desert. I climbed the hill behind the camp. From there I looked first towards the river. The blue smoke from the cooking fires was smeared out across the surface, mingling with the streamers of river mist. The riding lamps on board the ships were reflected in the dark waters. It was still too dark and far to pick out the vessel upon which my mistress lay. I turned then towards the east and saw the light bloom over the desert with the nacreous glow of pearly oyster shells. The light hardened and the desert was soft and lovely, the hillocks and dunes shaded with mauve and soft purple. In the limpid air the horizon seemed close enough to touch with an outstretched hand. Then I saw the cloud, suspended on the horizon beneath the unblemished aquamarine sheen of the sky. It was no larger than the end of my thumb, and my gaze wandered past it and then drifted back to it. I felt no initial alarm, for I had to stare at it for a while before I realized that it was moving. "How strange," I murmured aloud. "The beginning of the Khamsin, perhaps." But it was out of season, and there had been no charging of the air with those malevolent forces which herald the desert storms. The morning was cool and balmy. Even as I pondered it, the distant cloud spread and grew taller. The base of the cloud was upon the earth, not suspended above it, and yet it was too swift and wide to be of any earthly origin. A flock of birds might move that fast, locusts may rise that quickly to the skies, but this was neither of these things. The cloud was ochre yellow, but at first I could not believe it was dust. I have watched herds of scimitar-horned oryx galloping through the dunes in their hundreds upon their annual migrations, but they had never raised a dust cloud such as this. It might have been the smoke from a fire, but there was nothing out there in the desert to burn. It had to be dust, and yet I still could not wholly believe it. Swiftly it grew, and drew ever closer while I stared in wonder and in awe. Suddenly I saw reflected light twinkle at the base of the towering cloud. Instantly I was transported back to the vision of the mazes of Amun-Ra. This was the same scene. The first had been fantasy, but this was reality. I knew that those beams of light were shot from war armor and from blades of polished bronze. I started to my feet, and alone upon the hilltop I shouted to the wind a warning that nobody heard. Then I heard the war trumpets sounding in the camp below me. The pickets on the heights had at last seen the approaching dust cloud and sounded the alarm. The sound of the trumpets was a part of my vision. Their urgent warning shrilled in my ears and threatened to split my skull. It thrilled my blood and chilled my heart. I knew from my vision that on this fateful day a dynasty would fall, and the locusts from the east would devour the substance of this very Egypt. I was filled with dread and with terror for my mistress and the child that was part of the dynasty. The camp below me was a tumult of men running to arms. Their armor glinted and their spearheads sparkled as they brandished them on high. They were bees from the overturned hive, massing and swarming in disarray. The shouts of the sergeants and the rallying cries of the captains were almost drowned by the braying horns.